Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and him, Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Kieran, how was your Valentine's night? Ali and I were slightly worried that you might go for a whole three-course romantic cheese and Guinness meal.
Well, I was busy travelling up to Liverpool to work, so it was a solo journey. So yeah, I'm not particularly in the Baroness's good books at present.
Well, if you just left the Baroness and Finlay sitting around the romantic dinner table together, I'm not surprised, Kieran. It's Newsday, and we're going to be beginning and ending with Americans, Kieran. And the first story is that US businessman Chris Kirchner is reportedly interested in buying Preston North End. Is this a serious bid or a bit of tyre kicking?
At present, I wouldn't read too much in it. For people not familiar with sort of some of the backstory, the Preston North End owner, Trevor Hemmings, he sadly passed away a few months ago. He was a pretty generous benefactor. I believe that the club is now being run by his son, but Trevor Hemmings was putting in around about £6 to £7 million a year every year. Yeah, that's the price you pay for trying to have a club which is keeping its head above water in the Championship. Chris Kirchner came from nowhere a few months ago and announced via social media that he was an interested party with regards to Derby County. He engaged with fans on Twitter, which is a good way of getting interest. And he appeared to say the right things. He flew across. He met Wayne Rooney. Looking at his background in terms of wealth, he's got a logistics company, which it makes far more money than the likes of you or I, but It didn't seem to be in the ballpark to give him £60 million to acquire the club, which is the sum that the administrators were looking for. So that did seem a bit strange. And then he withdrew from his interest in Derby County, again, via social media. And he blamed the EFL and he blamed Quantamar, the administrators, and he implied that Mel Morris hadn't helped as well, and it's everybody's fault but mine. I could have done wonderful things for these clubs, and so there was a bit of suspicion with regards to him, and his name is now being linked with Preston. And sort of reading the reports, he believes that the club has potential. The club can have a sustained attempt at getting into the playoffs and tipping for promotion to the Premier League. Again, all of the things that fans like to hear. Mm. But if he is going to go down that route, the chances are it's going to cost a lot of money. He seems as interested in golf and NFL as he is in football. Nothing wrong with that at all, of course. What we have seen historically is that you can get a disproportionate amount of publicity for yourself by taking some form of interest in the football industry, because as we've said, it's actually a very small industry with a very big media and social media following. So wait and see. I don't think he's a serious contender at this stage, but you can never say never.
So are there people then, Kieran, that are cynical enough to try and big themselves up in their own country, maybe by saying that I'm a guy interested in buying these football clubs, and that gives them a spurious glamour? Or am I being cynical by suggesting that?
No. I mean, there's quite a few people. We've seen Eric Alonso, who again sort of duped, I think, many people at Derby with his interest. We will be talking a little bit later. In fact, one of our other stories about a person. I don't want to put the guy down, but you know, he goes into my delusional fantasist category of owners, past owners, prospective owners, I wouldn't say I'm a member of the fan club. Perhaps for the live show, we should have a discussion. Perhaps we should put together a five-a-side team of favourite wrong-uns in terms of football ownership. And tickets still available, of course, 24th of March, AFC Wimbledon, Plough Lane. All goes to a good cause as well.
Yeah, only a few tickets available, I might add. We perhaps will have a five-a-side team of wrong-uns, Kieran, but we need to persuade producer Guy, first of all, that we can do that safely within legal limits. As it turns out, as I was told recently, you can't just say what you want on stage. I've been living with the fantasies. That's all right. I can say what about Prince Andrew? I'm just me and a microphone. This lawyer said, no, not quite as simple as that. probably best ever rethink or talk to a legal friend. Trevor Hemmings, of course, sadly missed in another sport, as he was a huge supporter of National Hunt Racing. One of those club owners who fans don't really know what they're losing until they've lost him, in a way, because he just quietly gets on with looking after the club and you know, the opposite of Chris Kirchner, doesn't seek publicity for doing so, or didn't seek publicity for doing so.
Yes, yeah. And again, you always have to be a little bit cautious about drawing too many conclusions from social media, because often the empty vessels make the loudest noise, and I am an empty vessel. I make a lot of noise myself, so I'm fully aware of the hypocrisy of what I'm saying. But there was an element within the fan base who thought that him putting in the equivalent of £100,000 a week into the club that they follow wasn't generous enough. And I'm going, well, you know, £100,000 a week is pretty big commitment, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Kieran, you are far from being an empty vessel. You still make a lot of noise, but it's not because you're an empty vessel. This is a very strange story, I think, Kieran. Very odd news about the ownership of Sunderland.
Yes. And again, I appreciate that Sunderland fans will say, well, we all know this anyway, but for fans of other clubs who perhaps have come to know Sunderland through the excellent Sunderland Till I Die documentary. Yeah. So let's just go into the backstory. Originally, there was an owner called Ellis Short. He tried to run Sunderland. From a business point of view, it was an absolute nightmare, even though the club was in the Premier League. I think he lost the thick end of £150 million in Sunderland. But he then sold it to effectively three parties. Stuart Donald, who was the owner of, I think, of Eastleigh, and then Oxford, who sold his interests. A guy called Charlie Methven, who is what we up north regard as all Southerners, in the sense that he came across as a very posh bloke who didn't seem to know much about football. And a guy called Juan Sartori, who is an Uruguayan businessman stroke politician. So they were involved in Sunderland, and at the start they said all of the right things. Stuart Donald was on the terraces with the fans. Charlie Methven came out with the piss party stops here.
Yeah.
The piss take party stops here. Ears were just pricking up in our listeners in Hamburg there for a second. And in his
this is why we don't win.
And he sort of classic middle management style, you know, turns up with lots of flowcharts and spreadsheets and so on.
Well, you need flowcharts and spreadsheets for a piss party, Kieran.
That's true. But unfortunately, in his very first meeting, he revealed his red underpants when leaning over and sort of that lost a lot of credibility. Yeah, okay. If you're from the Northeast, you don't wear red underpants. So it was all very weird. And then that ownership started to unravel a bit, because I think fans began to realise that how did these three owners, how did they pay Ellis Short to acquire Sunderland? And it looks as if the club was using the parachute payments from the Premier League as a means of paying for the club, and therefore we didn't see much investment in the form of players. Sunderland went down into League One. Sunderland are the only club to have received parachute payments for 2 years, I think, in the Premier League. In League One, and they clearly they're still there at present. They just lost a match 6-0, which led to the manager going. Fans are a bit unhappy. So 12 months ago, after a lot of attempts to sell Sunderland, Kirill Louis Drayford came in, and we were told at the time, or rather the story was a bit vague. He's a 23-year-old billionaire because his family's got inherited wealth from Monaco. And of course, the fans think, well, hey, you know, the good times are going to roll. We're going to invest in new players, get straight back up to the Championship. Then let's get back to the Premier League, where the Sunderland fans feel that they have a right to be there, and there's nothing wrong with those viewpoints. Things haven't worked out particularly well on the pitch as far as the first 12 months, and you've got to give a lot of credit to, first of all, some of the Sunderland fans themselves, who have started to do a bit of digging. And then in the last 48 hours or so, Phil Buckingham at The Athletic, he managed to get an answer from the club, because what we've seen is evasion, vague answers, words which could be interpreted in a variety of ways. And it now turns out that Kirill Louis Dreyfus doesn't control the club, because he only owns 41% of the shares. And Methven, Donald and Sartori, between them, own 59% of the shares. So they had become toxic. Yeah, we've spoken about breakdowns of relationships and toxic owners. Stuart Donald is great copy as far as the tabloids are concerned, because he left his wife for a lap dancer. He comes across as a bit like David Brent in the Sunderland Till I Die documentary. All good fun stuff.
Yeah.
Unless you're a Sunderland fan.
Yeah.
The signing of Will Grigg has gone down in legend in terms of how they ended up paying a lot of money for a decent player, but well overpaid. So that's where we are at present. I think the Sunderland fans feel let down because there's been a lack of transparency and clarity from the club. They don't want Donald and Methven at their club. To be fair to Stuart Donald, he doesn't attend matches. Charlie Methven has been seen at home matches, which I think if you're winning, football is a completely different game. But once you start losing games, people are looking for people to get angry about. And Charlie Methven is the type of person, if you're from the Northeast, it's very, very easy to get angry about, because as about a bigger manifestation of the establishment as you could expect to be.
If you're from the Southeast, Kieran, you can get angry about people like Charlie Methven, and indeed him. What I don't understand about this, Kieran, is how, because the narrative, I hate using that word, but it's the industry I live in. The narrative was such that when the lad from Marseille bought the club, nobody was reporting that he's bought some of the club. It's like Sunderland are now under new ownership and the sunlit happy days are ahead. I just don't get why this was kept secret. And also, it seems to me that the club is stuck. This is the worst of both worlds. They can't really move on if you've got two such different types of people owning parts of the club.
Yes, it's really frustrating. You know, people will say, well, he is now the biggest single owner of shares in the club. He has appointed some directors, so this is indication that on a day-to-day basis he's involved. But my view would be if he's as rich as people claim him to be, why did he only buy 41%? Whenever I'm advising any people in terms of M&A, mergers and acquisition work, I'd always say you've got to have more than 50%, because that gives you control. And why buy 2/5 of a cake? Because you can't control if the other parties, if they gang up, they could act as a cartel. Because they've got a majority interest. And there's no evidence that they have done so. There's no evidence that Stuart Donald's involved in decision-making. But if that is the case, why didn't he just go and sell his shares at the time? Because if Dreyfus is as wealthy as people think he is, it should not have precluded a sale. Sunderland was probably going for around about £30 million as a whole club. And that's a good night out for a Monaco-based billionaire.
And meantime, Sunderland fans have got the double whammy of having to look along the coast and see Newcastle enjoying the newfound mega riches. And people often forget that Sunderland are a team with as big, if not bigger, a tradition in football as Newcastle. So these are really galling times for them. And as you predicted a couple of weeks ago, Kieran, the aftershock of the European Super League is still going on, and the Times reported this morning that the Big Six of English football, or the Silly Six or the Greedy Six, whatever way you want to refer to them, have refused to sign a Premier League charter, and it's all to do with the future of Europe, isn't it, Kieran?
Yes. We did see in the immediate aftermath of the Super League creation and collapse, although it has to be said, Manchester United, Chelsea, Liverpool, Manchester City, Arsenal, Spurs are still, as far as we are aware, are still shareholders in the Super League company. Now, there could be legitimate reasons why they can't forego those shareholdings. And that's one which is dragging through lawyers' negotiations at present. But in the immediate aftermath, there was very much we've made a mistake. We hold up our hands. We should have thought a little bit harder about this. And we're going to learn the lesson. Fans, I wouldn't say I don't think fans necessarily believe them, but I think the attitude of most fans would have been, well, let's give them a chance to prove themselves. And what we've seen since then is very much crumbs from the table. Mm. There's talk about having some fan representation, having more meetings between fan groups and a board member. Certainly some of the things within the within Tracy Crouch's fan-led review, the clubs were probably willing to concede on. Things such as changing the colour of the shirt or changing the name, the badge, because those are actually pretty easy concessions anyway. So it doesn't really involve. One of the things that I think many fans were uncomfortable about with regards to the Super League was the notion that it was a closed shop. You were in the Super League on the back of an invitation, and we had the idea of permanent members of the Super League. We've almost got that in the Champions League at present, but 6 into 4 doesn't go, as we know. If Newcastle's owners do invest significant sums, the 6 could become a 7. So 7 into 4 makes it more complex still. So what the upper echelons of the Premier League have wanted is some form of guaranteed participation, or close to guaranteed participation, in the Champions League itself. And we were talking only recently about the UEFA have said, we've now got substantially more money from 25. So the rewards for getting there are even much higher. So it now appears that there was an owner's charter being proposed at the Premier League, and the owner's charter, one of the commitments was, we will only seek to participate in European competition on the basis of sporting merit, i.e. this crazy notion that if you win football matches, you get a reward. You qualify for the European football. And this doesn't sit easily with some club owners, because they will point out, and you know, you can see it from their point of view, is if we don't qualify for Europe, the Champions League is going to be worth £150 million if you get to the final. Even if you get to the group stages under the new Swiss model, it's probably worth somewhere in the region of £40 to £50 million. So that's an awful lot of money to have to forego. Yeah, what would happen, for example, if West Ham have a good season and they get in the top four? That's absolutely outrageous. Yeah, the Glazers, John Henry at Liverpool, they seem to think that being part of the Champions League is theirs by right, because they've got lots of people who like them on Instagram, and they're opposed to sporting merit. So there has been a pushback in respect of this owner's charter, and the Sneaky Six have said, no, we're not signing it. So I think that's pretty reprehensible. I think it's indicative that the desires and aims of people at the top of football in terms of their ownership is not in alignment with what we have as fans. And even when you talk to fans of, you know, I was at Old Trafford on Tuesday night. I was talking to some United fans. They said, well, you know, we've been pretty mediocre this season. We're now scrambling for fourth place. But if we don't get it, well, it's our own fault. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got more money than anybody else. So it comes down. I don't think there's, you don't see from fans saying, oh, we should sneak in on the basis of a UEFA 10-year coefficient on what we've done in previous years. And this is what the owners are trying to do. They are trying to de-risk their clubs. And there's already a huge gap between the top six and the bottom six. And if you do an analysis, and this is spreadsheet fun for those of you that like this type of thing, if you actually analyze the number of points on average of clubs in the top six and the number of clubs on average for clubs in the bottom six of the Premier League, that gap has grown and grown and grown over the course of the last decade, because the Premier League is becoming less competitive. What they are wanting to do is to effectively to put up a glass ceiling to make sure that lack of competitiveness is embedded forever.
So the top six are essentially banking on the fact that as UEFA are dropping heavy hints that in seasons to come, if West Ham, Leicester, Brighton, God forbid, were to sneak into the top four, UEFA would say, I'm really, really sorry, that's not getting you a Champions League place, because Liverpool, Manchester United have got way more points than you on the totting up basis because they've qualified before. Essentially, that's what they're banking on. But what there's another thing I don't quite understand, Kieran, is presumably this went to one of the legendary votes in the Premier League, and you need a straight majority of 14, which implies, or doesn't imply, it indicates that a club outside that traditional top six voted for it, which you would imagine would be Newcastle, wouldn't you?
Possibly not. I think in terms of this charter, this is independent of an executive officers meeting.
This is
what we want to do going forwards, and there is pushback. And in terms of the European places, I think the top four will always get in. But what UEFA have said is, because the Champions League is increasing from 32 to 36 clubs, how are those extra four positions going to be allocated? And that could be on the basis of your 10-year record in Europe. So let's say if West Ham finished fifth and Manchester United finished sixth, Manchester United would then take that place, even though West Ham had finished in a higher position. And that stinks. Yeah, it goes completely against everything we've ever done in respect of the history of football. If Yeah, if they want to make the Champions League a bit more exciting in terms of participation, then perhaps of the top three qualify automatically, and then of playoffs between positions 4, 5, 6, and 7, and that would keep the interest going, I think, for the whole competition. But funnily enough, the big clubs don't seem too keen on that.
I know the big clubs certainly not keen on my idea of improving the Champions League, which is by getting rid of it and replacing it with this system whereby the champions of each country go into a kind of draw against each other in a sort of knockout fashion. I don't know if that would ever catch on, but I suspect
that sounds too socialist to me, Kevin.
I know. Imagine that. You just have to go through a cup competition. This next chap, this fictional five-a-side team of wrong-uns that the live show has, may or may not include this next chap, Kieran. I don't want to spoil the fun for the people coming to the show, or indeed find myself in court, because you talked about people earning more money than us at the moment. Just this couple of weeks, Finlay is probably earning more money than me just for a couple of weeks. So I don't take the risk. But Lawrence Bassini is the ex-owner of Watford. He's a sort of chap who, Kieran, you would probably agree with me, would describe himself as a character, I imagine. Just for a bit of context, the admirable Football 365 describes Lawrence as a decade-long soap opera, taking in 2 bankruptcies, a name change, several court cases, and repeated attempts to buy clubs without providing proof he had the funds to do so. So that's the sort of character we're dealing with. But now one of his companies claims that Charlton Athletic owes it £1.7 million.
Yes. So Lawrence Bassini was the owner of Watford. He did end up with a 3-year ban from football on the basis of some of the revelations with regard to his ownership. I know some people that ended up working for him. I think it's fair to say they didn't respond positively to his accuracy in terms of some of the things that he'd said and promised. He may or may not be the delusional fantasist that I was referring to earlier, of course.
Hang on. Sorry, Kim. I'm just looking through the rest of the questions. Yeah, I know. That's him. It is, yeah. Yeah, it is. Just so you know.
But Lawrence Bassini, he has some form of connection to Matt Southall, who for a brief period of time was the owner of Charlton. And here, in terms of Bassini's latest efforts, we've got to give a huge amount of credit to the Charlton dossier. If you get a bit of spare time, just go and read the Charlton dossier in respect of what has happened at that club in terms of recent ownership. Now, it looks as if Lawrence Bassini has a company called Bloom Properties. Lawrence Bassini presently is a director of around about 12 companies. Bloom Properties appears to be itself subject to a winding up order, which he didn't seem to mention at the time. He is claiming that he is owed a £1.7 million introduction fee for getting Matt Southall involved at Charlton, which we've all sort of introduced mates to blind dates,
Not for money, Kieran.
If somebody wants to offer me £1.7 million to meet some of my mates, especially from the cricket club,
the Prowler.
Sadly, the Prowler's spoken for, size 5 is spoken for, and he's known as size 5 because he's the only man I know whose head is perfectly spherical. So it actually resembles a football. And so from the age of 16, to be known as size 5, he's more like Frank Sidebottom than Frank Sidebottom.
Oh my lord, that's very funny.
So that's where we are. How serious can we take this in respect of Lawrence Bassini? I think the club appear to be relaxed, but it has been in some of the newspapers. He's a person that if he ever does get near a football club, I would really be concerned. And unfortunately, because so many clubs are in desperate straits, he turned up at Bolton Wanderers on one occasion. He was involved. He was claiming he was going to take over Charlton, and to do this with with what appears to be a lack of millions is quite an achievement. But he, as you say, I think Football 365, he is a soap opera, and provided he's just treated as a soap opera, then that's fine. What you don't want is people like him getting in control of clubs.
Can I just check this notion of the introduction fee in football and in business, Kieran? Because in my industry, you will quite often say, I'll put you in touch with an agent, or I'll put you in touch with the producer or the owner of a comedy club, and you wouldn't expect anything other than a pint for doing so. But so in business, is this a common practice that you will ask for £1.7 million just to get you in the door?
Well, you might ask for it. I'm not sure you'd necessarily get it. But, yeah, certainly the concept of headhunters and, yeah, that's what headhunters do. They are introducing the two parties together, and they will get a commission. And sometimes you will delegate a form of, you know, a group of headhunters to do something. There's no evidence that Lawrence Bassini has any of those skills, though.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamacq, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
You know that Champions League final we were talking about earlier that Brighton and Palace will never get in?
Yes.
Well, if we were, we'd be laughing, because UEFA are planning to give away 10,000 Champions League final tickets for free to fans of the two clubs that get there.
Yeah, and on the face of it, this sounds fantastic. It's 10,000 to the Champions League, it's 8,000 to the Europa League, 6,000 to the UEFA Conference League, and 6,000 free tickets for the Women's Champions League as well. So a grand total of 30,000 free tickets. I think it's, and that's great. I think there's a few bits of confusion. Yeah, first of all, how are these tickets going to be allocated? Are they going to be allocated by UEFA, or it would seem more sensible for the clubs to allocate them? If the clubs are going to allocate them, then upon what criteria?
Yeah.
And then if people do get hold of those tickets, I'm not being rude, is everybody going to attend the match, or are they going to end up on, you know, via GoGo, or being sold to hospitality packages? So for my view, it would make more sense to have, rather than have 10,000 free tickets, why not reduce the price of the cheapest tickets to something which is genuinely affordable for all, and spread that discount, which affected is, you know, for the posh seats, yeah, you can keep them at the high prices, but for the, you know, for the seats behind the back, behind the goals, and as many as possible, there is a huge issue in terms of pricing for these competitions. It sounds great, but it also just seems a bit odd.
Well, also there's an element of divisiveness here as well, Kieran, because almost guaranteed the clubs that are in the Champions League final are going to be big clubs. The chances are 90% of the time you're looking at huge, massive clubs with very, very big fan bases. And I think if you're a person who's, you know, you've been to every home and away game, Chelsea, for example, and you've racked up all the points necessary, and if somehow you don't get a ticket and yet somebody who's possibly never been to a game before gets a free one, it just seems odd. As you say, it's the concept, it sounds generous, but the concept sounds odd. And also, from what you know about UEFA, you can't help thinking that most of these free tickets will probably be in some sort of corporate area anyway, or you've got to win a competition or go into a draw. So it's a strange one. We'll do a bit more digging to see if we can find out more about the criteria, because it's an interesting story. But to all those people who say we only talk about bad news, Kieran, here's some good news for Coventry fans, hopefully. Long-running dispute over the sale of Coventry City Stadium has come to an end.
Yes, whilst it has come to an end, it's not necessarily the end that the club owners had hoped for.
Okay. So
you and I know Coventry. You know, we both went to Highfield Road.
Best away game. Coventry and Ipswich, best away games in the country.
Yeah, yeah, and I remember the last time I went to Coventry, it was when they just moved to the all-seater stadium as well. So that was you know, early 80s. That felt very strange at the time. But you know, Coventry then moved, and I'm still going to call it the Rico. I know it's officially the Coventry Building Society Bowl or something, but it's the Rico to all football fans. And this was something, again, we've spoken recently. When it comes to naming rights, it's a case of being first or not at all, as far as the majority of the country is concerned. Now, there was a dispute with regards to ownership. It is now effectively controlled by Wasp Rugby Club, and Coventry City are the tenants. But the owners of Coventry City, who are a strange hedge fund based in the middle of British Virgin Islands or Cayman Islands or somewhere, called Sisu, they've had an ongoing lawsuit in respect of the council. They said that the stadium was sold at too low a price, and the council wasn't acting in the best interest of Coventry City and so on. And they've been appealing, and it now looks like the highest level of court has said, well, we're not willing to take this any further, and if you want to appeal, you're going to have to go to appeal to it's going to cost you an absolute fortune. So it looks as if Sisu have now perhaps taken legal advice and said, we are no longer going to pursue trying to get back either ownership or financial compensation in respect of the Coventry Building Society, whatever it is. So instead, they are now focusing their attention on some land which is owned by the University of Warwick, with a view to building a brand new stadium there. Is the city of Coventry large enough to warrant two large stadiums? Well, you could perhaps say the same about Nottingham, for example.
Yeah.
So yeah, Coventry is a decent, but it does seem a bit strange of a thing to do. What's the capacity going to be? We don't know. What's the cost going to be? Because labour costs and material costs in the construction industry have gone through the roof. And it's a greenfield site. So therefore, there's likely to be significant objections. And you know, certainly from the experiences we've had at Brighton in all of the loops that you had to go through to get to where we are and actually having a stadium, that can be quite a long, time-consuming, expensive process as well. So it looks as if going forwards they are going to try to find somewhere of their own, but don't expect the first shovels in the ground for a year or two at least.
Yeah, I know it's Ali's neck of the woods, so I know the site they're talking about. It's rather not just green, but leafy. And the good people of that part of Warwickshire will put up a fight, I imagine. There will be travel issues as well. It's not that well served public transport-wise. So it would be nice to see Coventry back in there again. It still seems strange that Wasps are playing up there anyway. Now, this next news story, Kieran, I told producer Guy I'm happy to include it, even though it's up there along with the surprising news that turkeys are not that fond of Christmas and that bears' toilet habits tend to be al fresco. according to producer Guy, 75% of players don't want a World Cup every 2 years.
Yes, this is research undertaken by FIFPro, which is the global players' trade union, and they've sent out questionnaires to their members to say, you know, in the light of Gianni Infantino's enthusiasm for a World Cup every 2 years, what are their views? And as you say, overall, three quarters of players are opposed to it. they are concerned about burnout. And it does very much, very significantly continent per continent. So, for example, in Europe, it's far higher than 75%. I think in Africa, I think it was only 49% were against it. 51% were in favour of a 2-year World Cup. It's difficult to work out who would be the beneficiaries of a World Cup taking place every 2 years. If the players are against it, there doesn't appear to be a lot of enthusiasm from legacy fans. But again, you know, I put the story out on social media, and the response of some people was, well, it will give us a chance to, it will double the chances of England winning the World Cup in my lifetime. I'm thinking, well, England have won the World Cup in my lifetime, but that's probably me showing my age. What's going to happen to the European Championships, which they take place every 2 years? We've got AFCON, we've got the South American Championships. How is it all going to be squeezed in? That's not certain. And of course, you know, if it does take place every 2 years, that is going to substantially reduce the amount of drowning taking place in the Mediterranean Sea, according to Mr. Infantino himself. So you know, perhaps we're being too harsh in our somewhat eyebrows raised curiousness as to the proposal.
Yeah, I'm still not entirely sure of his warped logic about that story, but I'm too tired to go through it again. So new listeners need to check that. The other thing as well that people. Or fans of the idea of a World Cup every 2 years. And you know, let's face it, we all love the World Cup. Despite my opposition to where this year's World Cup's going ahead, I'm actually starting to get excited about the fact there is a World Cup coming up, and it's a novelty factor of a Winter World Cup. But it's not just the actual World Cup itself, Kieran. It's qualifying games. It means that probably you can't imagine that there will be a week without some sort of qualifying game going on for either the Euros or you know, other regional world tournaments, or the World Cup, and of course that comes with extra expense for especially the smaller nations, the Liechtensteins and the Andorras, who still want to take part in these competitions. They're trudging constantly around Europe playing games. It just doesn't make any sense.
This is where Arsene Wenger's plan comes in. He has proposed that instead of having 3 or 4 international breaks in the season, each year in October / November, there is a 4-week break from domestic football, and all of the qualifiers take place during that concentrated period of time. And that could have some merit, and it could actually be very good for clubs in the lower leagues who don't have players going out on internationals. So therefore, you know, fans of the bigger clubs might say, I'll go and watch my local non-league team, my local League One, League Two. So it could have some potential merit, but it also means that, you know, if your star forward is injured during that month and you are one of the smaller nations, you know, let's say that you're the likes of Wales and so on, Gareth Bale is injured for that month, you practically lose out all of your chances of qualifying. And I'm not saying that Wales don't have any other decent players, because they do, but you know, he has been fantastic talisman for the nation. So I think there are some potentially solutions, but even so, we've got competitions taking place every year. This summer we've got the as well as the FIFA World Cup, Men's World Cup taking place in the winter. We've got the European Championships taking place in England for the women's game. Now, if we're going to have a Men's World Cup every 2 years, the women's game, which has been squeezed historically, is going to be squeezed even further. And I think that's something which is either not being taken into consideration or has been taken into consideration at a token level by the upper echelons of FIFA. And then they've said, it doesn't matter. Just think of the money we'd earn from World Cup finals every 2 years. And it is being driven by money. And they can try to dress up the story in whatever the way they wish. The TV rights from World Cup finals are very, very lucrative. And as we've established, the countries hosting the World Cup, they're the patsies in all this because they think they're going to make a lot of money from it. I can assure you, South Africa 2014, South Africa 2010, Brazil 2014, Russia 2018, and Qatar 2022 will all make huge financial losses for those host countries. They can dress it up as whatever they want, but the real financial numbers tell a different story.
Yeah, to all our Welsh listeners and Welsh friends, especially Cardiff John, I'd like to take this opportunity to distance myself from Kieran's implication that Wales are a small country. I'll just leave a pause there. Cardiff John, if you're listening, he said that, mate. I didn't say it. But while we're in Wales, unfortunately, when I said we're not all about bad news, this is a bad news story. Bangor City face expulsion from Cymru North League if their outstanding fines aren't paid.
Yes, this is a this is a bit disturbing story. Bangor City have been pretty successful in terms of Welsh football up until fairly recent times. They were suspended a few years ago. They were relegated on the back of being refused a licence by the Welsh FA. They then had a 42-point penalty, which was eventually halved, which stopped them going into the third tier. So they've been bumbling around. But things in the last few months have really deteriorated. I think there's £53,000 of unpaid wages. And we are talking lower tier football here. Yeah. So that's substantial amounts owed to both management and players. The club was relatively recently acquired by Domenico Serafino, who I believe is Italian, and I don't recognise. He's that doesn't sound like he's from the Valleys to me.
It's quite a decent sized. If you go to the holiday outlets, there's quite a few Italians in that part of the world, Welsh Italians, serving out lovely ice cream in beautiful 30s style restaurants.
Oh, cool. I have to give it a try. If Cardiff John lets me into Wales again.
Well, I was thinking more Llandudno, which is where Ali was raised. Having said that, Warwickshire's her part of the world. Her dad was a vicar, so they moved around a lot. So as a small child, she was brought up in Llandudno, where apparently the ice cream is better than anywhere else in the world. Ooh. And you know what Ali's like. There are certain hills I'm not going to die on, and the best ice cream in the world is one of them, essentially.
I used to run a double glazing company in Wrexham.
Did you?
Yes. we got off on a tangent again, haven't we?
Yes, we have. Oh, well, we'll save that one for the live show, Kieran.
Yes. So, Mr. Serafino, again, a bit of digging reveals that he used to own an Italian football club, and that went bust. So, it's not great. And I think the deadline for paying the unpaid fines. We are recording this on the 16th of February. We are talking days away from where the deadline is. So, this will be a tragedy if it takes place because, again, community, identity, history, heritage. Bangor deserves a football club. I think fans have set up some form of Phoenix club because I think the fans are genuinely concerned as well. But, it's not something which is good news.
And these outstanding fines are in respect of outstanding wages then?
Yes. Right. Yes. Okay. Yeah. And I believe there's some county court judgments as well for unpaid creditors.
And, of course, what you forget is that these players, the anxiety of waiting for money that you possibly will never get while bills need to be paid and food needs to be put on the table. It's just wrong. Anyway, our penultimate story, Kieran, is about a place where you were this week. Manchester United have signed a sponsorship deal with Tezos, who are, as the club described, one of the most advanced and sustainable blockchains.
Yes.
All right, we'll move on then.
Yes, I was at Old Trafford on Tuesday night. Unlike the trams in Manchester, which decided after 200 meters of me being on a tram that the whole system was going to break down because I think somebody had cut the cable somewhere on the network, We don't know the full story, so it was only, I was only going from blokes on the tram who were getting stories from their mates, but they seemed to think that somebody had either cut the cable or some Mancunian scallies had nicked some of the cable, because it's clearly worth quite a bit of money. Manchester United have been their training kit sponsor is historically from a company called AON.
Yeah.
This has been replaced by Tezos. We're talking somewhere in the region of 20 to 25 million pounds. Now, I'm like you, I'm a bit uncertain about what blockchain does. I think it sort of works on the basis of, if I want to transfer some cryptocurrency from my account to your account, how can we prove that that's taken place? Well, blockchain is a fact that lots of people on other computers will confirm the elements of the transaction. So Tezos also appears to be involved, or is certainly at least tenuously linked to the world of NFTs, which is an area which we have discussed, and also fan tokens, which is where I think a lot of football clubs see as being the next vehicle through which they can, horrible word, monetize or lift money out of the pockets of football fans.
Yeah, two things, Kieran, off the back of that. We had that very interesting interview with Peter McCormack, the owner of Bedford, who's a Bitcoin apostle, guru, whatever you want to say. And while the interview went down very well, we did have quite a few people expressing their disappointment that we didn't discuss the environmental impact of such things. And to be perfectly honest, at the time, I didn't realise there was one. But of course, there is, and that's something we will be looking at. But also, it was interesting, Crystal Palace, my club, launched their own fan token scheme at the beginning of this week to great fanfare. And Palace fans have almost completely ignored it. There was a report that it's been the lowest uptake of any Premier League club that's introduced these tokens. There's been no response from the club as to how they feel about it. But I just wondered what your thoughts were on that, Kieran, because the club really did push this for 4 weeks before they launched it. I know from experience and WhatsApp groups and talking to people in pubs that there was still some confusion about what it actually is. And of course, there are still those fans who will buy anything that's red and blue or got an eagle on it. And I'm sure they have taken up. But I thought it was very interesting that the response, I think around about 30, only about 31% of Palace fans again, you could say that's 31% of quite a few people. But I don't think the club can be that happy about the outcome. Or they may think it will take some time for it to become the sort of common currency that fans understand all about.
Yeah, well, my first comment is to say fair play to Palace fans, because I think there is legitimate scepticism as to what clubs are trying to do. Now, you and I are probably both old enough to remember the old club lottery tickets.
Yeah.
I used to, when Brighton were in the lower divisions, we were skint. I'd pay my £2 for my weekly Brighton over Albion lottery ticket. And I think on one occasion I got a signed photograph or a signed program. And you didn't mind doing that because it was, as you say, if it's in red and blue or blue and white, but it doesn't matter what the colours are, it's your way of helping the club. Yeah. You know, things aren't great financially. That money is handed across in good grace. You know, it's effectively a lottery draw. You don't expect to win anything from it. What we are seeing with the fan tokens is, first of all, there is the overuse of this word engagement.
Yeah.
And once you start to ask questions of football clubs, is what exactly do you mean by engagement? Because when I go to Waitrose to get my quinoa, I don't think, I only wish I could spend a few more hours a week engaging with Waitrose in an alternative manner, which gives them money and gives me the opportunity to get a signed menu card by some, for some, Guinness and cheese soup, for example, whatever it's going to be. So I think clubs have realised that they do have fans who can't get to matches, And what they want to do is to lighten the wallets of those fans, as well as the fans who do attend the matches. And this is the vehicle that they're trying to use. It's fan tokens. And again, if it's done as this is a form of a lottery, you'll be given these tokens, and you can buy the tokens. But in order to buy the tokens, quite often you have to buy them using a fan coin, which is a form of, some form of cryptocurrency. But you can buy these tokens, and then you can spend them on the lottery tickets or whatever. And if as long as it's sold in that way, I really don't have an issue with them. But as soon as you go on to social media, as soon as you start to look at what some of the big players in this industry are trying to do, is that they are either explicitly or via a dog whistle approach trying to market and manifest these products as a form of investment. Now, this is where I get really concerned.
Yes.
I would not ever advise anybody to invest in something that they don't understand. And I would also never encourage anybody to invest in something which is unregulated, speculative, highly volatile, and easily open to manipulation. And this is where my sense of discomfort comes. So, I thought Peter McCormick was a very engaging interviewee. And also, it was interesting to hear him say that he is involved with Bitcoin. He doesn't have any involvement with any of the other cryptocurrencies and so on. Bitcoin has the advantage of effectively being first and being biggest. And that gives it, through weight of numbers, slightly more credibility than some of the other products. Remember, over 1,000 cryptocurrencies have come and disappeared.
Yeah.
So they can be used for nefarious purposes. As a means of transferring money, again, I think they're absolutely fine. So I think Crystal Palace fans are right to be cautious and sceptical, and I think it's incumbent upon the clubs and the likes of Socios, who are the big players, and I think we will see the Premier League try to introduce this as a as some form of revenue generation. UEFA have just announced a partnership with Socios. Without going into too much details, that they were in contact with me, inviting me along in hospitality to a match because they feel that I don't understand what they're trying to do, and that I think they wanted to educate me.
Oh, do they know you don't drink?
Yes.
that live gig we're doing on the 24th of March is, I'm afraid, Kieran, now 100% guaranteed to start with you saying fair play to Palace fans. And then with a bit of judicious editing, when you just said Crystal Palace fans are right to be cautious, that's just going to be you saying Crystal Palace fans are right. You've got to be very careful, Kieran, I told you. Now, our last story, as I predicted right at the start, because I know the script, is also American based, and there's a two word phrase in this story, Kieran, I'm really looking forward to saying. New York City, who were part of the City Football Group, which of course owns Manchester City, what a result they had in Europe, by the way.
Yes,
but New York City has secured a multi year tie up with Chicago based men's grooming brand Dude Wipes. Yeah, Dude Wipes, man. Woo, Dude Wipes. This is a...
This is fantastic news.
Well, it is, Kieran. At the risk of alienating one of our most loyal sponsors, I'm not shaving down here. I can't see any circumstances in which I'm going in the shop and saying, you got any Dude Wipes? You know, I've got some tissues. Yeah, I want Dude Wipes.
Yeah, well, these appear to be... the equivalent of, baby wipes, but aimed at men, which presumably means that they're a bit bigger. To be fair, it's a shirt sleeve sponsorship deal, which is a shame because, if they had back of shorts sponsorship, that would have been a perfect logo for the perfect place. I think it is showing innovation. And to be fair to both New York City and the sponsor, they have marketed it in an appropriately self-deprecating way. So, unusual. Yeah, I'll stick to my my aloe vera Waitrose best toilet roll for the moment, but an unusual product. But it must have, you know, a fair amount of sales, because, you know, shirt sleeve sponsorships aren't cheap.
Yeah, there's going to come a stage, Kieran, where one player at the start of a season is going to walk into the dressing room, look at the shirt of the new sponsors, and go, "Ah, no, I'm not wearing that. I'm really not." Or will just find himself right at the back of the team photograph with his arms folded across the logo. Thank you for listening today. If you'd like to make a small contribution to our always free to air pod, then please go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. And if you have a question for our regular Monday questions pod, it's questions@priceoffootball.com. And in the meantime, I shall, of course, hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, as always, folks, thank you for the engagement. Horrible word to use, of course. Thank you for keeping us on our toes with plenty of questions. And also to everybody that's supporting us on Patreon and other vehicles. If you want to come along and see us, remember 24th of March. Say Kevin said, we've been really quite chuffed to bits at the level of sales today, but there are still a few left for that particular our debut gig, and we might be giving some fan tokens out, because it could also be our final gig if things don't work out. But if you want to support us in another way, you should give us some good karma. If you can hop along to your app on which you use which you download your podcasts, and you give us a review. Producer Guy says that if you can give us 5 stars, it helps us as far as the charts are concerned. And by all means, leave a review. It doesn't matter what you say. You could even say you'd rather the show was presented by Judy Sook and Bob Carroll G's. Now, this is my attempt to, because Producer Guy's trying to get us a live show on BBC Three, and this is my attempt to appeal to the kids, because that's the particular demographic that listen to BBC Three. So just to show you, I'm not an old fogey.
Yeah, to all you young people out there googling those two names, Judy Zook starts with a T. Yes. Don't go looking for Z. It starts with Bob. Imagine us having a BBC Three show. That'd be hilarious. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miroboard. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miroboard?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.